Today's episode is brought to you by Majingo. We'll talk about it later in the show, but thanks for sponsoring.
Yay!
Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast about web design, development, mostly hanging out in the front end. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody.
And we have a special, very special, special guest. Chris, you want to introduce?
Mean Gene Crawford. How you doing, Gene? Thanks for hanging out on the show with us.
That's great. I also go by Dancing Machine.
Dancing Machine. I once saw Gene Crawford bench press a bus full of school children. True story.
Gene is from period three, little agency kind of thing, although we'll see. I don't know. What's the best way to describe it? Unmatched style, conferences like Converge SE, which you're just fresh off of, is that right?
Yep. Yeah, getting down off the high of that sucker.
I bet it was fun. Me and Dave have both been to Converge and then sadly missed it this year, which I felt tremendously guilty about. It won't happen again, Gene.
Thank you. Yeah, seriously.
How'd it go? Tell us about it.
Oh, man, Converge this year was incredible. We hear a lot of things, and I just try to live up to expectations. You know, that's the hardest part, right? But generally, it was awesome. Same as the year before, but twice as good. one of the crazy things was Friday night, we had what's called AlternaCirque, which is like a bunch of fire eaters, glass eaters, trapeze arts. Came out and did some cool stuff for us. I think that might have blown some people's minds a little bit. But
I think I heard of a new game that where you have to like thumb wrestle and like draw like ampersands on each other's chests at the same time.
Man, yeah, I can't take credit for that. That's Nate Croft's brainchild from
Shop Talk Show listeners will recognize from episode something where they were on.
Something. Yeah, it's called thumper sanding. Thumbersanding. I don't know if the B is silent, but thumbersanding. So it's like you said, you thumb wrestle and then you draw an ampersand on the other guy's chest with your offhand. And you get points for drawing an ampersand correctly, and you get points for pinning your opponent.
Yeah, so there's some strategy then.
Yeah. Strong thumbs, apparently. Chris.
Half the battle.
Yeah. Carl Smith actually kicked my pretty well. In a haphazard battle.
I want to play it. That's all I have to say. Okay, let's see. I have a few on my list, my file here that I look at on my screen during the show. Normally we start out with news and links, and we don't have a ton of stuff. We're going to get into Q&A as soon as possible here. But one of the things we talked about on the last episode with a guest, or maybe it was a rapid fire, I can't remember, but we were talking about like health and the workplace. You know how we all sit in chairs all day at our desks and stare at our screen and probably don't get up as much as we would like or exercise as much as you're like. It's a certain sedentary lifestyle that a lot of us live. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't presuppose bad health. I think I was saying in that episode I work with some like crazy healthy people that like, you know, like bike across the world and like do stuff like that and have 0% body fat. But you know how it goes. A lot of us are a little heavier than we should be. Anyway, I'm definitely in that category myself. I thought we would. There was one article, but one was by Lewis Lazarus, who runs that Impressive Webs. It's a very nice site. Who has a? And I'll put this link in the show notes. Health tips for web developers. Who kind of? And it's just a nice rundown of all the different kind of things you can do to stay healthier with our sedentary lifestyle. And then Paul Sayer wrote in. I used to have back pain from working so long. That was until I read an article suggesting running would prevent the pain. Apparently, running strengthens the back muscles, which ache after long periods in the chair. This has really helped me. And as I was listening while I was running through a half marathon, he was literally running while listening to Shop Talk Show. Yeah, you're the only one. My advice for getting started is the same as Chris's for learning web development. Just go do it. So I guess, you know, it does seem a little weird. Like I'm having back pain. I should go for a run, you know, but you know, Paul's saying it worked for him. If you're having back pain, it makes sense. I've always heard that like doing sit-ups helps it randomly. Like you need strong core muscles to help with your back. Anyway, I thought I'd share Paul's story about being healthier in our chair-ridden life.
No, it's important. I think you need healthy habits. So, and if your gut's smaller, your back will hurt less. Science.
Right. What do you guys do?
I heard if you're a grasshopper, you don't even have a back.
Wow.
That's also science.
I don't do much. I do a little bit of ab stuff, but not enough, obviously. But I totally sense the difference, though. So highly recommend.
Bench presses buses of school children. So he's
clearly
as healthy as here.
That helps me, yeah, the children and the school buses.
All right. So for hot drama this week, there's some more talk about vendor prefixes. I don't know if we're super prepared to talk about all this, but probably a lot of the people that listen to this show are more up to date on it than I am. Remember when Mozilla came out and said, hey, we're going to start supporting some dash WebKit prefixes for CSS properties? And then it turned out really they're only going to do it in their mobile browser, which is like super new and it turned out to kind of not be as big of a deal as all that. Well, now Opera said they're going to do it too. They were a part of those original conversations, only people focused on them less. But now the conversation is all about Opera because they're not only doing it on their mobile browser, but on their desktop browser too. So stuff like, and they, you know, they're very upfront about it. They said it's going to be, you know, gradients and box shadow and whatever. They named the ones that they were going to do, and it's going to be in their desktop browser as well. So people a little fired up about it. What else? What do you guys know about it?
Well, I mean, there's like two sides. So there's like the browser's argument that, you know, lazy web developers have pushed them to this, you know, and evangelism is broken down and doesn't work. Like Opera evangelists or Firefox evangelists will email sites like Facebook or somebody, or maybe Facebook's a bad example, but they'll email people and say like, hey, this site is like fundamentally broken in Opera. Would you mind fixing it? Here's what you need to do to fix it. And Those people would be like, yeah, we're not supporting that. And so like, to some extent, browser evangelism has broken down, and I agree with that, but you also gotta just try harder. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if you need to do like extreme things like, you know, kind of breaking our understanding of how CSS is supposed to work. I kind of side on that side, but David Kaneda, he used to work at Cincha, but I think he has moved on from there. But he wrote a couple of posts. He has a 9bits blog. It's a Tumblr blog.
It's a great Tumblr blog to follow.
Yeah, it's like gives you all this like cutting. Or he also runs WebKit Bits, he's a WebKit fan, obviously. But he's a little biased. But WebKit Bits is a great blog, and you should follow it if you want to learn like cutting edge WebKit stuff that's coming out. But over on his blog, he posted about his reaction, and I think it's a well thought out reaction, and I probably side with him on most cases. I mean, WebKit's kind of a big deal. There's no one true WebKit. You can't really say that. But he had a post where you always hear like Opera is the biggest mobile browser in the whole entire world, man. You got to support it, man. But it's like he like kind of took some stats and broke it down and was like, dude, mobile WebKit's actually like three times as large in that like it has like an over 60% browser share or something. And then Opera is actually split up into two Operas, Opera Mini and Opera Mobile. Opera Mobile is good. Opera Mini is a proxy that kind of hacks your website just like
kind of sends you like a PDF of your website, kind of.
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. So I think this drama will probably continue to cycle forever. But I like David Kaneda's points of view on that. I highly recommend you read them.
The argument being that if all browsers start doing this, it's kind of, I don't know, it, like, the future will implode or something, right? Like the long-term implication, like the short-term implication is not a big deal, like, right? I think we feel like we've talked about this before, but short-term is like, well, more websites work, that's a good thing, right? And the long-term view is, you know, making developers even lazier than they already are. Like, why include Morven? It will just only use WebKit forever, because that seems to work, and all browsers are supporting that, so it makes us even lazier than we already are, and that's bad long-term. And lots of different arguments. And there's this also this new thing that was making the rounds on Twitter the other day called, instead of vendor prefixes, doing vendor bangs, which is a bang being exclamation point, like, so exclamation point important works in CSS now, that being bang important, and some kind of thing about that being that we can just use kind of the proposed syntax. We don't have to then, it's just like forward compatible, I think is the idea, although I wish I should have read up on it a little more, because I don't know what's going on. Anyway, that's the
close enough.
Let's get out of this. Let's cut our losses here and get into Q&A. What do you think?
That sounds good. Q&A, obviously, as you know, is the meat and taters around here. We like to get questions, especially recorded audio questions. You can do that over at shoptalkshow.com/ask. Duh. And you just ask a question. So we're going to get into that. The first one is from Barry Maxwell, and it's an audio question. Here we go.
Hey guys, great show. I'm a designer, front-end developer. I was going to put together a WordPress site for clients, and then they came back a little bit later. They're like, hey, I've been playing around with Squarespace. What do you think about Squarespace? Maybe we should build a site in that. And they'd already done a bunch of kind of work. And I told them, you know, I don't do Squarespace because it's kind of a proprietary thing, and that's not my focus. But thank you. Even though, you know, I probably could noodle around in Squarespace. What are your thoughts on that? Bye.
Well, I want Gene to start the the question was, let's say you had a client, and the client was like, so you've built the website for him, you show him a mock-up, you know, and you're already down the line a little bit with this client, and all of a sudden they're like, what about Squarespace? And you're like, but I already wrote all this markup, I already have it in the CMS, the client, I mean, where would you take that?
Well, it sounds like something, you know, went wrong earlier in the relationship there. You know, we've done a lot of client work, that's what we sort of cut our teeth doing over the years, right? Been doing it for, I don't know, geez, a long time. Mm-hmm. You should have had those conversations like way earlier, right? Like when you're talking about design and stuff, you should be getting into how you're going to execute it, likely. But in the case of that, which sounds like maybe somebody just went kind of nuts on whoever that was, at that point you have to make a decision. You have to, you know, either confront them, take the opportunity to explain what you do, like he said he did, and be willing to walk away at that point, because that is a bad situation.
Yeah. I mean, you're kind of advocating just like having a stronger and more specific relationship with these clients. Like for them to spring that on you means that you probably weren't talking about the right thing soon enough, possibly.
Yeah, you don't want to just disappear through the process, right? You know, this part of what you're doing is building a website is, or I'd say half of it is education, especially now. Holy crap. I mean, like, how do you even approach telling a client that you're going to build a site that's responsive or that's, you know, forward thinking?
I heard somebody on Twitter the other day, like, how I approach it is I ask them to take their phone out of their pocket, you know, because they probably have a pretty nice phone these days. And
I don't like statements like that, though. You know, I read a lot of that stuff too, and it's always so cut and dry, like, I'm just awesome, you know.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you know, you probably are, but they still are confused, you know, and that's where a lot of that comes from. They just don't know what's coming next. They don't know what you're doing, and you disappear for a month and come back with this thing on your phone, and you know that's probably not a good situation.
Right. So in Barry's case here, he was talking about the client went to Squarespace, and Squarespace is like a hosted CMS kind of, or that is what it is. You want to start a blog, it's great for that, but it's good for any kind of thing. It's like a, you know, WordPress.com is really kind of more for blogs, it's for writing and that kind of thing. And they're in that same genre a bit though. But they have Squarespace is more kind of, it's more kind of front-endy, right? You're like, you pick a theme kind of thing, and you're like looking right at it, and you're like, I want to edit this bit of content, and you click it, and you kind of get this overlay view of editing that content. It's been a little while since I've used it, but does anybody use it more actively?
I've looked at it pretty in depth myself. I didn't mean to cut you off there, David, but it's come a long way, man. It's like you can get in there and really customize it. You can put your own markup on top of it.
I just wanted to mention that because I didn't, you know, in Barry's question here, we weren't trying to say that, ooh, your client went to Squarespace, gross.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, no, Squarespace is pretty cool. It's just that it, like, you do have some limitation, right? Are you saying you can customize markup
too,
though?
Yeah, you can. Yeah, yeah.
So markups, but what?
But Barry sounded right, though. I mean, it is proprietary, right? It's like any choice, like, do I use that? Do I use Verb? Do I use Tumblr? Do I use WordPress.org? You know, .com, right? So .com, you know, yes. Where I put this thing.
And if Barry ran a business that just allowed clients to arbitrarily choose whatever, he probably would be less efficient, right? It'd be better if you were running a business that like you used, you either made static sites for your own, or maybe you just work on Squarespace, especially if you're a small team. It's hard to just be like, okay, I guess I'm going to learn the ins and outs of Squarespace now. And your very next client was Verb, both very good projects, but you're like, oh, now I have to spend all this time, you know, to use your word, cutting your teeth on yet a new thing. Yeah. And then, you know, in Barry's case, he's already further along the line of this client. It's just at some point you got to just be like, you know, no, you know, yeah. I'm going to do what I already did.
Business 101, right? It's like maximizing profits of, like, yeah. You know, that's how you do that. You build little systems and processes, and just like you said.
And what's the advantage? You know, like if Barry's along and he's got this good website already going, the client's like, what about Squarespace? You're like, what about it? You know, like, mm-hmm. what's the advantage of?
I think that's what it is for me, is why did that guy choose Squarespace? And my guess is what Squarespace does really well is you can just, like, you know, hit escape and you're logged in, and then you like click something and you edit it. He probably, I mean, this is my sniffer. I'm not making character judgments about this guy, but the guy's probably like a tinkerer, and he wants to tinker and edit every little piece, every little section, every little text block of his website, which Squarespace does really well. In WordPress, you have to do some kind of heavier lifting to get him to be able to edit everything in the whole website. So my guess is that guy's probably a tinkerer, and he's going to tinker. So, I mean, I'd let that guy do his thing, because he's probably going to ruin the old website really fast. So
probably
that's historically speaking, but unless you have like a really good, you know, relationship. But in general, like when people like change the architecture, like later on, that's sort of a scary deal. Like what Gene was saying, if, you know, you probably should have had your CMS and everything discussion kind of finalized and proposed sort of beforehand. But you know, nothing's going to stop the guy or the marketing guy from like being like, hey, I made the website, check it out. And it's like in PowerPoint or whatever. And then you're just like, I don't know what to do with you. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Barry, you win one of our books. You're one of our book winners. You sent in an audio question, and that's what it took to win the book. Yeah, that was awesome. Responsive Web Design book by Ben Frain. God dang it, I forgot what it was called. I'm sorry, Ben Frain.
We'll fix it in post. This is
no, I'm fixing it right now. Responsive web design with HTML5 and CSS3. We mentioned it on the last episode, and we're giving away 3 copies today. Barry, you're our first winner. We have 2 more winners that we'll pick, and all it took was sending in an audio question, which you did. Good work.
Yeah, that's a cool book too. I thumbed through it, and it's it's cool. I think I got a copy. He sent a copy. Anyway, hey, there you go. But it was like a it's kind of like, it's good. It's got some technical tidbits. It's cool. It's
okay. Good.
Yeah. Anyhow, let's
indoors.
Move.
Yeah, let's move
indoors. Next question is from John Notlong. Awesome last name, John Notlong. Built first web page in 2003 at 13. Learned about CSS 2004, age 14. Learned about WordPress 2005, age 15. Got first job at web dev company in 2011, age 21. Now it's 2012. He's 22. How many years of experience does he have?
So he worded this a little more long-winded-ish in the email. I'm not complaining, John. You rewrote it out very well. But I wanted to get to the nuts and bolts of it, because his question was, like, he's starting to apply for jobs now or in the market a little bit. And a lot of these jobs ask you, how many years of experience do you have? And he's saying, well, literally, he built his first web page when he's 13 years old, and now he's 22. Does that mean he has 9 years of experience? Or does the math work out on that? Not sure. Or does he have 1 year of experience because he got his first real kind of professional job 1 year ago?
Hmm. And
so, you know,
that's a true question.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know. Are you awesome?
Yeah, that's kind of like, I would say the question should, like, I know some place, you know, if a place really cares a lot, and that's like a big, they'll throw away your resume if you don't have these arbitrary years of experience they're asking you about, then you should say 9.
Yeah. all of them.
On your LinkedIn, put 9.
Yeah, definitely 9. Maybe even throw on a few more just for fun. Yeah, I would say 9, you know, because that's such a, you know, it's kind of a dumb question. Really, who cares how many years of experience you have? If you have 2 weeks of experience and you're like an amazing illustrator, then you can work for me. I will find some, find something for you to do. Not that I'm like hiring, because I'm not, but yeah. You know what I mean, right? Would you hire, what would you, you know, you ran a web dev agency, Gene. You've hired people before. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Absolutely. You know, Giovanni, you know him. He's an amazing illustrator. I mean, go to convergesc.com and check out that dinosaur. I mean, holy
I love it.
But, you know, when we hired him on, he had no practical experience. And now he's hanging with you guys, you know, just because he's awesome. And that's what you look for. You look for that
awesomeness,
not like, you know, how many years of experience. But that's, you know, we were like 3 dudes, you know, and he was number 4. You know, if you're a big old company with hundreds of employees, you got to cut through the haystack somehow, right? So you just do these arbitrary things, and I don't know. I guess it's where, you know, he's applying for a job, it sounds like, but, you know, where do you want to work? And then
right.
You know, yeah, like you said,
if you're trying to get in that sales force or something.
Yeah, you're gonna
need. It's a little different.
9 years and et cetera. Yeah. But if you're trying to work for somebody,
but even them, I feel like they should look at your GitHub commit log. They should look at your online website. They should look at your Twitter feed to see that you can write a tweet that is intelligible. You know, like there's a little bit of like social proof to being kind of a decent hireable person. That, you know.
There is.
And who cares about this number 9? You know, I feel like that's a sucky thing to have to look at. But once in a while, you gotta cut through the crap or whatever. And to get your resume even looked at, and you got to put a 9 on there to do it, then put a 9 on there.
Yeah.
I would also have a backup number when they go, wait, 9 years? Are you serious? Then you'd be like, but seriously, I don't know. Maybe you like take the total number of hours and divide by 40. And then you get a number of weeks. You divide that by 52, and then you have a year. It depends. Like from 2005 when he was 15 to 2011 when he was 21. What did he do those 6 years? Was he like in his basement playing Call of Duty, or was he like
yeah? How many websites did you build?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's sort of what matters maybe to
sure.
me.
You, but maybe I mean, you should have the oldest social proof that you have. You know, like if you have a blog post and it's marked 2006, maybe you should say 2006, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah, yeah. And I mean, it depends on what, like, your... I mean, how, yeah, I think it depends on time. I mean, like, I started back when I was, like, that young, back in 1994. Oh, my gosh. But, whoa. You know, I... So I guess I do have all that experience, but, you know, it was only... I would go into fits of, like, full-time, 40 hours a week, you know, kind of ingestion of web learning. But then I would drop off for school or whatever for months at a time. So I don't think it'd be fair to say I have 31 years of, or whatever, sorry, 17 or something years of experience, but it's like, but I have been making websites for 17 years. So that's kind of weird, but
yeah, maybe you could say it that way. Maybe you could say like, look, man, I've built websites since I was 13. I've been doing it professionally for X.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's a good way to classify that.
Yeah. In the chat room, Trent, be confident and tell your story. You know,
yep.
That's a good way to say it. Okay. Let's see. Brian Miller asks us, I'd love to hear how you guys are handling images for the Retina display. What do you recommend for building in today's world? It's the big question of responsive images. Preface to this is I have been working all week long on a frigging post about dealing with responsive images, and I just haven't been able to click publish on it because it's such a huge topic going on right now. There's lots of different JavaScript methods for dealing with it. The problem being, right, so all of a sudden the new iPad came out, right? The mm-hmm. third iteration of it, and it has this really dense pixel display. And people are finding that, like, if you have, like, a little icon of a triangle or something, or a more complex icon, that they kind of look bad because they got to scale up a bit on there. And it's like, if it's SVG or something, it looks super sharp. But if it's this little raster image, it can kind of look kind of bad. So, but if all of a sudden we started doubling the size of every image that we ship, that's making our websites heavier and slower. So that's not a super good option either. The ideal is to serve our little icons when we are in an environment that they're going to look fine on, and then flip them out for higher res icons. And it's not just icons. It's every image on a site, really, is what we're talking about. Send out the larger version when we're on a screen that needs it, and kind of that the bandwidth is available for us, and we're not slowing down the thing too much. So sorry that I'm kind of hijacking this question, but that was kind of the preface. And Brian is asking us, how are we dealing with it today? What's the world like? Well, there's lots of different solutions. There's pure JavaScript ones that kind of run little media queries and kind of flip it out as needed. There's ones that rely on back-end technology. There's third-party services doing it for us. There's lots of different ones. The goal of my blog post is to kind of look at each one and kind of ask some real-world questions about it and kind of guide people to the right thing. And then there's the whole conversation of what's the future going to be like for these? Is the W3C doing anything about it? All this stuff. Have you guys dealt with this in reality? Have you shipped a website that deals with responsive images yet?
No. We just relaunched Unmatched Style, and we're really struggling with it. You know, Jay Barry here is sort of our guy behind the curtain, kind of, you know, that mm-hmm. sort of builds everything that me and Gio come up with, all the crazy dinosaurs and stuff. But you know, we just relaunched Unmatched Style, and we have a serious problem with that, in that we made it responsive and our site is nothing but giant JPEGs. You know, it's just mm-hmm. a bunch of images of websites, and they're huge. They're like
literally
900
like
pixels
wide. Inspiration gallery, right?
Yeah, so we really have to deal with it. And he's got some techniques that he's working on, but no, I mean, it, you know, Dave and Chris, I mean, solve it for us, you know?
Chris Glayer.
You helped us
out.
You're
my only hope.
I feel like a small plugin, a small jQuery plugin.
A tiny jQuery plugin, you say.
I mean, excellent. Come on. This is what you guys do.
I'm working on one now, and I've been using Uncle Dave's old padded box, which you guys may remember from a blog post.
But, so you're talking about making a div in place of the image and possibly like dropping the image into the background of that div. That's
exactly
that uses kind of media queries to determine which one should be there. Is that?
Yep. And that's how I've been doing it. I mean, Tim Kaldek, he has a post on whether or not that actually works. and it's kind of mediocre results, but,
sure.
But, for me, it's solving it. I don't think in all circumstances it defeats the double download penalty, which
you So what he's want. Talking about there is, so to make a really semantic image, you have to have an image on your site, and it has to have a source attribute that actually points to an image. And as soon as you have that, you can't fight the what Dave's calling the double download, because as soon as the browser gets to that image, it will start downloading that thing. Even with JavaScript, if you flip it out really quick or do some other fancy thing with CSS, you're going to get whatever the new image is that you've determined is the more appropriate one and the one that's already in the source. And that doubles the download, which is causing a performance penalty when what you're trying to do is increase performance. So you're like, ugh. So a lot of these things are putting a little tiny transparent GIF as the source of the image, which still allows you to have proper alt text and people will still see the image, but then people are having problems with that. Like, is that really semantic? Brad Frost has this tweet that's like, well, an image of a horse has to be an image of a horse. Otherwise, it's not an image of a horse. which
right.
kind of sums it up kind of, you know.
At what point do you start getting penalties like the Black Hat SEO penalties for...
I don't know. I would hope Google's being cool about this because it's kind of a real problem.
Yeah.
Then there's things like Sentia.io, which is just preface the URL of where your image is with Sentia.io, and it will, in the back end, Sentia does like UA string testing, and it will serve an appropriately sized image in the place of it, but that's relying on a third party. So then there's things like adaptive-images.com, which is kind of like a locally hosted version of Sentia.io. People in the chat room are mentioning Retina.js. I'm not a huge fan of that one because it's a little specific to the iPad and not kind of future thinking, but... then there's Foresight.js, which a lot of these are just screen size based. But what about bandwidth testing as well? Foresight.js and both High Source by Christopher Schmidt deal with bandwidth testing as well. So that's kind of an important aspect of this. You know, like if you're on an iPad 3, but you happen to be on like really crappy 3G, you may be okay with little fuzzy icons as long as the friggin' website loads, you know.
That's how we fought it. We just cached the living dog crap out of the site.
Yeah, you know, like, sure.
That's only goes so far, but you know that's
well.
How
yeah, and then what kind of caching is it? Is it local caching, or is it? Are you trying to utilize browser cache as best as you can, or using local storage or application manifest stuff? Or
like, yeah, I mean, and then who can do that? You know, it takes a special developer.
And then that's great. Like on desktop browsers, the cache is nice and reliable-ish, but on mobile browsers, the cache is way small or non-existent. Certainly doesn't work for big images. It's a world of shit. Sorry.
Hey. Ding dong. no, it's like it's just a world of pain. I think somebody wrote it about it on .NET Magazine. Was it Matt Marcus Wilto on Twitter? He wrote
about
it.
So those are the two, like there's, you know, Ethan Marcotte and his fluid images and stuff, really groundbreaking stuff. Then the two guys that are really like breaking the most ground in this world, three really, are Wilto, Matt Marquis or whatever, Grigsby, and
Scott Gell.
Yes. And those and Matt and Scott Gell are both Filament Group people. And so one of the proposals for the future of this is, okay, we can think about all these JavaScript ways to do it and backend and third parties and all this stuff. But really, the W3C should be helping us with this. It's a problem now. It's not going away. There needs to be, you know, the standards should be helping us with this. So there's a W3C group that I think Filament Group started called the Responsive Images kind of group or whatever, where people are talking about it, blogging and commenting. And I think the strong, like the front runner, and please, somebody please correct me if I'm wrong, is the picture element, which is, you know how you can have video and you can have audio in HTML5? And in between those tags, you list sources. You list source equals and then the different like formats you need. Well, with the picture element, you'd list different sources, and instead of them being different formats, they'd be the same format, but they would have a media query attached to them. So these different sources would only – it would ship the one in which the media query matches, which is cool, but it's not valid. You know, it's like new. It's, you know, like what if the spec ends up being different than that? Whatever. It's pretty cool, though. It allows for really good art direction. It's nice. And Scott Gel has a polyfill, so you can just start using it right now. It solves the multiple images downloading problem. It's pretty good.
But it's only for – or, well, he says it's experimental, don't use it like in production code, but it's just for inline images, which is kind of the big problem. Background images you can more or less, I think it's okay to do, but for inline images I think it solves it. So
that's the bigger conversation, I think, because in background images kind of dance around media queries and adjust background size and stuff.
Specifically for Retina though, Trent Walton just posted, my coworker Trent Walton, full disclosure here, he posted a post called Influx, which talks about kind of what Paravel's doing for Retina. We kind of were like, dude, is this going to ruin our day, like what we're doing? And turned out, nah. I mean, Retina does, it scales images pretty well. Like the density, it doesn't look totally bad. It's just when you have these highly rastered graphics, like your little 16 by 16 pixel things, those fall apart.
And that's exactly the kind of thing that vector fonts are good for. So
exactly. Yeah. So use CSS and icon fonts and you're in the clear.
So what I would say for you, Gene, though, is to check out that adaptive-images.com.
Yeah.
It doesn't require you to go back and change years and years and years of unmatched style markup.
Right.
Right. So it just you use an image tag like you're using it now. It has an HTXS file that looks like, oh, are you requesting an image? Instead of routing to where you were going to route for that image, route to this PHP file instead. The PHP file sees what you're trying to access and is like, and checks a cookie for how big your current browser screen is, and is like, oh, you're on a really small screen and you're requesting a really large image. Here, let me make a smaller version of that for you quick, and I'll serve you that instead. So it's super clever, and it works with your legacy content. You can keep using this normal image syntax like you always were. So for unmatched style, I would think that would be kind of the way to go.
Yeah. You get that, Jay? Get on it. Get on it.
Awesome. Matt Wilcox. Credit there. Good stuff, Matt. Okay. Gosh, we are
we've got slow. We should get going. Let's go. So next question from Ian Colshaw. Do you conceptualize outside the browser by means of paper, pen, balsamic when you're doing mock-ups and stuff like that? How do you guys tend to do mocks?
Absolutely. We start on paper with good old pencil, a big Sharpie or the wall or whatever. Yeah, that's where we start. It always starts with an idea, right? We're kind of nuts right now. We're really focused on making sure that everything we do has a strong narrative, you know? We get asked a lot about, like, can you make a site like Nike Better World? You know, like, yeah, but, you know, that starts so much earlier than Photoshop or, you know, markup in a browser or whatever. So, yeah, we definitely start as early as possible with a story or with a drawing or whatever.
Nice.
How about you guys?
Story. What does a story mean?
Yeah, well, yeah, like take the Converge site, right? Like, it's a dinosaur with stuff. Yeah. So, you know, and we call them Spanky, and it's funny, but there's a whole like idea behind that, and that's that, you know, we came up with this idea that you're peeling back layers to examine what it is you're doing and how you do it, right? So then we sort of build out that visual metaphor by doing something kind of nutty. We take a dinosaur, and then as you scroll down the site, his metal things come off and his skin comes off and you see muscle tone, and then that comes off and you see bone, and you know, you're peeling back the layers, and then we work this little narrative around each one of those stages, you know, as you go down the page. And that, like Nike Better World, that you're scrolling down that page and you're learning about these products and how Nike wants you to use them and how you use them and how you, you know, make the world a better place by not throwing your stuff in the trash can, you know, that kind of thing. So you're responding to this good narrative, but it's told and it's exposed to you in this really evocative visual way.
Yeah, and it's quite likely that they started conceptualizing that not by writing HTML.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So they're different things, right? You know, there's different types of websites. I mean, you know, you're like, I'm going to build a website for a doctor. Well, just, you know, crank open the browser and text editor and go to town, you know. But like, you know, if you're truly doing a bigger project, then yeah, you got to start way earlier. And we definitely start on, you know, sitting around the couch and drinking a beer with some ideas and sketching that stuff out.
That's awesome.
Sounds delicious.
I just saw Samantha Warren give her presentation on this thing that she does called Style Tile. So S-T-Y-L, style, and then T-I-L dot E-S. Are you a fan?
Oh, huge fan.
Me too. It's pretty neat.
She kind of launched that at Converge.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, awesome. Hey, but not really.
Most of us are familiar with this concept of like mock-ups, right? You're like, clients like, give me three designs, and you're like, cool, I'll do that. Some people are like, well, let's start with the mood. Let's pick some colors and some stuff out of books, and then maybe you can sign off on the mood before you do that. Or maybe you just move right away to mockups, and you're like, here's three websites. Which one do you like the most? Let's move forward with that. Mm-hmm. Style Tiles, I guess, is I mean, I'm probably butchering this. I'm sorry, Samantha, but it's kind of a mixture between that. It's more than a mood board and less than a finished mock-up, right? So there's like real fonts and real structure and real colors, but it's not a complete mock-up, you know? It's closer. And then that way you're, you know, it's not as loosey-goosey as a mood board is, but it's not as time-consuming as a full mock-up is. And so check that out if you're...
Yeah, when she went through that stuff, I was sitting by Giovanni in the audience, and we just looked at each other and just hugged each other and were like, holy crap, that's a cool idea. Yeah. It's one of those moments when you see it and it clicks in your head like, wow, you know, I just sped up this design process by like a month, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It really is. Yeah. She should get a button too.
Like I'd prefer making that to making a mood board. I feel like mood board's just not a mood board kind of guy. Maybe because
I always feel kind of goofy working on that. You know, it just feels like I'm so far away from the goal, but this thing is like, she should get a book deal out of that. Like, seriously, she needs to write a book.
That's her thing. And now that you have a thing, you have to have a thing to be like, to be like in the cool kid club and like talk at Event Apart and stuff. Like, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody that is the, and that speaks at those upper echelon things or whatever, like Converge. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? like Ethan Marcotte is the responsive design guy. Yeah. He's happy to have that. Like, that she will, you know, she's much more than that, of course, but this can be her thing for sure.
Yeah, and it's brilliant.
I'm jealous of that. I wanted a thing. I tried to be the pseudo elements guy, but
I'm not that smart. That's my problem.
Didn't take. All right, let's talk about Majingo for a second. Ryan Ireland's project. It's MIGINGO.com. And they're screencasts, but they're not exactly beginner-level screencasts. Not that you couldn't be a beginner and learn from this, but I kind of look at this and I think of these guys as like – it's like for people that listen to Shop Talk Show, really, right? There's probably most of the people listening right now is you're already a web designer. You're so into web design that you can't get enough of it. You subscribe to a podcast about web design just so you can hear more about it when you're on your way to your job as a web designer. You love it, right? So you guys are intermediate level, most of you probably, or advanced. I mean, I'm sure there's some beginners out there too, but intermediate, high five, right? I feel like Majingo are screencasts for you guys. Like let's look at a few titles for them. You know, one of the big ones they push is Learning Expression Engine, which is, you know, like WordPress is a CMS. Expression Engine is a CMS too, but it's a little more hardcore. I don't know if that's fair, but, you know, you have to know a little bit more about what you're doing to use Expression Engine. And then there's There's ones about MySQL and Expression Engine. So if you're using Expression Engine already and want to like extend it and kind of like get a little bit more serious about what you could build and customize with it, Ryan has screencasts for that, upgrading your versions of Expression Engine. But it's not all Expression Engine. It's just that's kind of how it started. There's a bunch of more like kind of intermediate programming style screencasts on Majingo. And it's a straightforward business. It's like, I want to learn this thing. Charges money. You get, you know, like this Learning Expression Engine series is 4 hours of HD video, really in depth, and he charges $48 for it, which is small potatoes if you are really trying to dig in and learn Expression Engine. So that's what Majingo is. Check out it, MIGINGO.com, and just look and see if there's anything that's up your alley, and I guarantee that you're going to get a lot out of it.
And I just want to say Ryan works at Happy Cog. He's a developer over at Happy Cog. So it's like, this isn't like Joe's whatever webcast. This is like real deal smart guy stuff. So I highly recommend it. And he has these Lunch With series, which is like, they're only like $5, but it's just like, boom, tackle a topic. Like he has like Budgets with Solver, which is like a Mac app, but like, create a home budget or, you know, maybe even like your work budget, just like, boom, knock it out, you know, learn how he does it. And I just think it's cool. It's a really cool deal. So yep.
Cool yeah. guy, and, cool product. Thanks for sponsoring. They are a sponsor of Shop Talk Show. Check it out. Okay. Two other people. Remember that book we talked about, Responsive Web Design with HTML5 and CSS3? We gave one book to Barry Maxwell earlier. Let's give away the final two. I'm going to give one to Jeremy Warboys. Congratulations, Jeremy. And one to... Oh, that was awesome. And wait, are you ready? Kyle Gordy.
You guys, and to all you other suckers... No, go ahead, Chris.
We'll have more freebie stuff in the future. But those three guys, I'll hit you up with an email to win. Randomly chosen from sending in an audio question. So thanks, guys. Next question. We got. Oh gosh, how are we doing here on time? We have like 15 minutes, right? Can we?
We got power through. Let's power.
Let's do at least two more. Okay. Steve Ross asks, can you tell me how to keep track of all the styles? Sometimes I need to create a style on the fly. What should I call it? Will I remember what it was when I may need to remove it several months later? Are there other terms such as footer, header that help break up different parts of a website? Naming things and keeping track is what gets the best of me. When writing CSS, is there a trick? What do you think?
Gene, any tricks?
So it's scalable. Like, here, let me set the
style sheets
a little bit. You're on Unmatched Style, and all of a sudden you're like, I want to add this little part at the bottom of the. I want to add a poll to the sidebar. So you're like, all right, I'm gonna just add a poll, and you're like, all right, it's been a while since I've worked on this site. What should I? I've kind of. Forget the. I'm not exactly in the mindset of it anymore. I'm gonna just. I guess I'll just make it like div class poll. I guess, and then you like chuck an unordered list in there, or maybe a header tag that says like, "What's your favorite dance move?" And then some. And then you just kind of write the markup for it. But you're kind of like out of the swing of thing. And then you crack open the CSS file, unmatched style. That's CSS, and you're like, "Where should I put this class of poll?" And you just kind of scroll to the bottom and you find
slap it in there.
Find some media queries and you're like, they should be above that probably. So then you scroll back up a little bit. You're like, how about here? And you just put dot poll and you write the CSS, right? Isn't that how we do it?
Yeah. But look, I'll let somebody else answer this. If you've all heard of Jonathan Snook, he's got a whole series out, Smacks. And it's like scalable markup and CSS or whatever. And it, you know, you read the description and it sounds like this is for giant websites, but really it's like a way of approaching just what you were just talking about, you know. And go read that seriously.
There you go. That's one. So it's kind of, there probably is some best practices in there for dealing with this kind of staying organized with stuff like that. What would you say? Have you had this problem, Dave? Have you like been like, oh, crap, where do I put this new class?
Yeah, no, it sort of, you just lose it for a second. You're just like, I don't know what to do. The HTML5 boilerplate has some pretty good tips. Like, basically, you just, in your CSS file, like, make a comment line that's maybe like two or three lines tall, right? And then you just say, and it's got big lines that go across the whole screen, and it says, this is my CSS reset, or, you know, you're kind of commenting through your code. But we have flags that are like, I think every CSS file we do is almost like it's the CSS reset. It's elements are like global styles, kind of like your body thing, your container, stuff that you know is not going to change, the grid, for instance, that comes next. And then next comes like elements, like what does a standard P tag look like? And then next is typography, and maybe you flip those around, but typography, what does an H1, H2, H3, what does an A visited, A hover? So we kind of have like, we just have these flags and comments in CSS that are really giant and really easy to find. So when you're like scrolling through your CSS, you can just be like, boom, there it is. And, you know, and then you go from, you start global as at the top, and then you get specific as you go down. So like at the bottom of the page, I'll have like page about, very specific code goes here. And that's all like off the page dot page hyphen about class or something like that. I mean, so you just, your style sheet should probably get more specific as it goes down. So, and maybe you have a whole section for widgets or whatever. And I wouldn't call it dot poll or class poll. You can, this is dumb stuff, but I would call it widget poll, just so I know it's a widget module.
Start generic on the left and get specific on the right.
So is that specific to WordPress that you're thinking?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's sort of WordPress has widgets, but even still, I would call things
like that idea. Yeah, like crazy. When naming images too, I would always call it icon dash like thumbs up rather than thumbs up dash icon, because then if you use a naming convention that's more generic on the left, they like group better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Always, if you like are looking at your images folder, you'll see all your icons in one group. Because you were more generic on the left. I would say to Steve Ross asking this question about keeping track of styles, here's a couple strategies. One being, if you're using a preprocessor, you can just arbitrarily break things into smaller files. So if you're like, I'm writing this poll, I'm just going to make poll.scss and keep it all in there. And then later on, I'll import it where I need it into smaller files. So at least logically, all this stuff for poll is in one small place. It keeps me organized. Or if you don't work like that, maybe you could have in your global style sheet, you import like deal with this later.scss. And you're like, if you're not in that CSS organization mindset, you're more in the like, I need to get this working right now mindset, that you could have this file that's like, this, just write CSS that you need right now and put it in this file that like reminds you to go properly organize it later. So you're not like blocking yourself, being like forcing yourself to think about something you're not ready to think about yet. And then it, like part of that structure, like a junk drawer for CSS, you know, and then go deal with it later when you're in that optimization organization mindset. Maybe just an idea. Let's do one more.
All right. One more. It's an audio question from Pedro Couto.
Hi guys. I'm Pedro, front-end developer from Portugal. I would like to ask you, which steps would you take for increasing the usability in your website, and which usability tools do you recommend? Thank you.
How do you increase the usability of your website, and what usability tools do you recommend?
Wow. yeah, you have to test it. You know, that's the first place. Have you guys, Dave, done any client-facing usability testing?
Yeah, we do some. Typically, like the client ends up handling that a lot of the time. But you know, we've done in the past. We've done a little bit, just a little bit of. Do you know that app, Silverback app?
I was going to mention that. Yeah,
Clear Left. It's made by, or was made by Clear Left. It might be its own company now, but it's got a gorilla for a mascot,
right,
which is the most important thing. And it's basically like screencast recording for usability specifically. So, mm-hmm. I mean, and the idea is you can just download this app, take it to a coffee shop, give it to somebody, and watch them click through a site, and it's all recorded, you know.
Their face as well as their...
Yeah, their face. So you can, like, see them, like, squinting or, like, see them just, like, pull faces, which is kind of, like, super convicting. yeah. I mean, you're just like, dude. But yeah, we do that. And we'll even do that to find out, like, you know, we all have our suspicions about, like, what's wrong with the current site? Well, it's dumb and I'm going to fix it, you know, but like, it's good for that even just to be like, to see where, what people are trying to get to or, and specifically do. Gene, you've used that before?
I've used Silverback for some sort of ad hoc testing. You know, what we've really had huge success with, we used it when we reworked Unmatched Style. We've used it to kind of prove some points to clients when we were redesigning things. And that's Crazy Egg. Have you guys ever heard of that?
Oh, yeah.
It's it's really cool.
It's like Click Map.
Yeah. And that's, you know, there's a lot of those, but it's just, it works really well. And,
what would you look for on a heat map? I always look at a heat map and I'm like, well, that's where people clicked. Good.
Well,
good,
look at it this way, right? Like, take Unmatched Style, for example. We have several places where we know the site gets a tremendous amount of traffic in the gallery, right? Duh, it's a gallery site. But you're like, how are people interacting with the gallery? How are they using it? How are they getting there? How are they getting from page to page, right? So we put this heat map on a couple of pages and we watched the homepage. And, you know, there's this big art, you know, we've heard this argument of like, don't put stuff below the fold, right? I mean, we know the reality of that. But we found that the highest clicked thing was a little button way down at the bottom of the page that just was like view gallery. It wasn't next. It wasn't back. It was just a link that said view gallery.
Really?
Right? And there was one on the header too, right? But it was the one at the bottom that they used. So when we were
blog post right there, man.
Yeah. So when we were redesigning, we thought, well, we got all these things. Like, we have a podcast and we have a conference and everything. So let's put like graphics as ads right below that button, you know?
Right.
And, you know, we haven't been running it long enough to really get, you know, 6 months of data or whatever that it takes. But, you know, generally right now it looks like it's working. So when you're looking at things like that, you're looking at a heat map that way compared to the stats that you already know, it can be pretty invaluable for making decisions really fast.
That's the second time I've heard this in the last short time. I saw Vitaly from Smashing Magazine do a talk about their redesign, and he showed one of the most clicked things was once you've like scrolled down on mm-hmm. Smashing Magazine at the bottom, there's like a more articles button, and that was like the most clicked thing on the page. I was like, my gosh, I need to take that to heart, because I think mm-hmm. that's true. People are just, they come and they browse a little bit, and then they're like, yeah. I don't really see anything that interesting yet. I should just click this thing that, gives me this new page of things that I might be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, don't screw that one up, guys. People want a more button.
The other thing that's really weird from the heat map that we found is that people click on other people's faces. If there's a website in our gallery and it's like inside the screenshot of that website is a photo of a person, people click the crap out of the person in the picture. It's weird.
Whoa.
They click around their face.
They punch them in the face.
I don't know what they're doing. They're just like, face. And it's strange. But
go to surveymonkey.com. There's, you know, a woman with a big smiling face right on the thing. And that would have been a very stupid thing for us to do, would be to have made that unclickable, you know?
Yeah, it's fun.
Give me the click.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like, what are targets? You know, we think of like, a target is just a big orange button or something on our blue website. And that's true, but there are other things that people do. And you can't foresee that stuff.
Mm. So Gene, most important thing of the day, how can people follow you, give you money, attend your conferences, all of that? How did they do that?
Yeah, go to unmatchedstyle.com. It's all right there. You can find us
love us, hug us, give us money, I guess. But more importantly, we link everything off of there. So unmeshstyle.com.
Cool. Cool. And that's great. Well, thanks so much for coming on to the show. We really appreciate it. And thank you for like not smashing your microphone in two and destroying everything.
I really enjoyed it.
Good. Cool. Thanks everyone for coming out to listen to the live show in the chat room. You guys are always make things the best, and you correct all of our wrong facts. Thank you very much. Chris, do we have any other information? Follow us on Twitter.
ShopTalkShow.com.